In his new book, Respect Yourself, the author Robert Gordon says that song became an anthem in central cities all over the United States. And a lot of other songs did as well and went way beyond central cities of the United States. Our guest is the author of Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion. And we'll be talking with Robert Gordon, who actually is a native of Memphis, Tennessee, and lives there right now. He's been writing about Memphis music and history for 30 years. Is the author of It Came From Memphis, Can't Be Satisfied, The King on the Road, and The Elvis Treasures. He won a Grammy in 2011 for his liner notes to the Big Star Boss set, Keep an Eye on the Sky. He also does film work and produced and directed the documentary Respect Yourself, The Stax Records Story for PBS's Great Performances. Stax Records is a very interesting story because not only did they give us some wonderful music, but also brought together black and white in a city that had a lot of racial tension, and black and white, not only people working in the office and running the place, but musicians as well. So it was a grand experiment that for the most part was successful until later on when everybody made too much money and how we all get along together. Robert is our guest this hour. We'll be playing a few tunes from some of the artists who were represented by Stax during the course of this hour. And you can reach our conversation by 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hi, Robert. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. We're going to have some fun. So you were a kid who was looking at who was inside the limousines in Memphis?
Well, I was just kind of aware of the world-shaking things that were coming out of Memphis when it was, you know, still a fairly sleepy town. It seemed like that whole musical thing happened in a shadow in this city.
Hmm. It's so amazing that this was quite some years ago, and you had all of this segregation going on, and it was really difficult to be African-American in Memphis in the South and so many parts of the country. And yet, at this record company, you had white people and black people who were working together, sharing the same telephone. I love the prominence of the telephone early in the book, and
yes,
appreciating each other.
You know, it seems like such a simple, quotidian experience today, and researching this story, I was reminded how far we've come in the past 40, 50 years. You know, just reading the headlines about the strikes, the pickets of downtown businesses. You know, where blacks were saying we want to be able to do our business where other people do business. That was a radical statement that resulted in violence.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. There was also so much talent. You think about kids playing music in their garages or skipping out of calculus class or algebra class to go
right,
play music. And there really was a lot of talent in high schools, young people in the Memphis area, wasn't there?
I believe that there's been a lot of music come out of Memphis in the past 100 years, really beginning with the blues in the early 1900s, going up through rockabilly and Elvis Presley and rock and roll in the 50s and Stax and soul music in the 60s and 70s. The reason I think why so much has come out of here has to do with this is a place where disparate people come together as the shipping point for all the cotton in the Delta. This is where that whole Delta culture came to, and this was also where the people who owned the plantations had their mansions. So on the street here, you'd have rich and poor, black and white, rural and urban, and I think it was that collision of cultures that has been responsible for the great art.
Mm-hmm. It always takes people to start something, and the people who started this were really interesting. Let's hear a little bit about Jim Stewart, who was mm-hmm. one of the founders, important, who was a musician himself, but his music wasn't going to be widely heard, but he made other people's music very widely heard.
Right. He realized he wasn't going to be, you know, that the place he could participate in the music industry was as a producer. Jim and his sister Estelle, they founded this record company called Stax Records. Jim's initial approach was to record some of the most bland, dietetic vanilla sounding music you've ever heard. And you know, it's the same guy who would soon be recording, you know, Wilson Pickett and Booker T. and MG's Otis Redding. So the story in part is how these two white siblings from rural Tennessee came to record such funky black sounds.
Yeah.
And you know, in the city where that kind of interaction was illegal and scorned.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phone conversation where Al Bell, who's an African-American who's brought into work and given a very prominent position and an important position and becomes crucial to the success of Stax Records. But how Stewart finds him, how he is brought in, and how everybody, from the accounts that you have in the book, everybody loved Estelle. Everybody seemed to enjoy everybody else, that they were functioning as a really great team.
Yes. They all used, you know, some words recurred in the interviews. The Stax family, that Stax was an oasis in the city, you know, culturally and racially. Estelle was Jim's sister. She lent him the money to buy the tape recorder, so that made her, you know, co-owner of the company. And they established their company in an old abandoned movie theater. She took over the candy counter and made it a record store. And the neighborhood where they established themselves was transitioning from white to black. This was in 1959 and 1960. So Estelle found herself selling more R&B than country, and she always liked to dance. So she, you know, that was easy for her to get to. Jim was a little more reluctant musically, or less prepared musically, but Jim says as soon as he heard Ray Charles sing What I Say, it was like a lightning bolt.
Mm.
And in fact, you can hear there's an obscure Stax song with a Ray Charles, early Stax song with a Ray Charles piano riff, and you're aware there, Jim is getting his Ray Charles jollies right there, you know.
And what was striking to him about Ray Charles? Why was that song so important to him?
Well, I think Ray is sort of the doorway into rhythm and blues. A song like What I Say in particular, what was that, like 1954, I think, 52, somewhere in there. What I Say takes church elements in particular and brings them into a popular context. And for a lot of people, that was the first time that they had heard this sort of Baptist church gospel sound. And that really is the root of much of rhythm and blues. And Ray Charles in particular was a master at it, and the way in for many people, both black and white.
Mm. Oh, I've spent lots of hours listening to Ray Charles.
You can't go wrong.
No, you can't go wrong with him. You mentioned Otis Redding. Let's spend some time on Otis Redding, because he tragically died in a plane crash in Wisconsin on December 10th. In what year was it he died?
67.
Yeah. And his story is interesting because I believe he was a driver for somebody else who wanted Stax Records to record him. And instead, Otis, you know, it's this be at the right place at the right time. Talk about serendipity. He walks into the place. And does he just start singing, or how does Otis Redding get noticed?
there's the myth, and then there's the facts. And I think the truth is somewhere in between. And what I'm referring to is he did come as the driver. What nobody at Stax at the time knew, and what he didn't tell anybody, was that he already had two singles out on other companies. So he was a noted, you know, not a noted, but a struggling singer. But when he arrived at Stax, he was the guy who drove the car for the star. The star had come up from Georgia, this guy, Johnny Jenkins, who was a showman on the stage, and they wanted to record a hit for him so he could sell it at his gigs because he was popular. And Otis drove him, and Otis took the Steve Cropper and Booker T. Jones talk about seeing this big guy and unloading the car with food and clothes and equipment. You know, he was the roadie, and that's what they took him for. And the other guy was dressed up and flashy, and he was the star. And they couldn't get anything connecting with Johnny Jenkins. Because really, I think he was a showman and the MGs were players, and they just couldn't make their groove come together. You know, the twain couldn't meet.
Mm-hmm.
And after a very frustrating, you know, 3 hours or so, these guys, the MGs and the players at Stax, were making their money at nightclub gigs. Otis had been bugging some of the players all day. You got to hit, you know, give me a shot, give me a shot. And so, and at the end, as the session was breaking up, someone reminded Steve, you got to listen to this guy. Steve Cropper was the guitarist and sort of helped with the production at Stax. Steve said, as soon as Otis started singing, the hair went up 3 inches on his arms, and he ran out in the parking lot and told, you know, told people, I need you back in time now. But I know you got a gig, but come on. And he came in and recorded These Arms of Mine. And a career was born.
We're going to hear another song, but this calls for a little bit of Otis Redding with one of his famous numbers.
I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. 'Cause I've had nothing to live for, and look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay.
Otis Redding and Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. And we're speaking with Robert Gordon, author of Respect Yourself, Stax Records, and The Soul Explosion. How did Stax make Otis Redding a star, Robert?
By letting him be himself. By letting him experiment in the studio and be himself. If Otis Redding had walked into Motown Records, or Wilson Pickett had walked into Motown Records, totally different things would have happened. Probably, not, you know, very possibly nothing. At Stax, these guys were allowed to come in, and the Stax players wanted to understand the artist and pull that funk that was in them out of them.
Hmm. Yeah, Robert had this thing about personality. I mean, Jim had this thing about personality, that to find the artist's personality in all the music, that he was interested in who they were.
Yes, well, I think exactly interested in who they were musically. Jim, the MGs who were the band for most all the hits in the first half of Stax, they talked about they would be playing and they'd look up at Jim. He was the owner and the producer, and if he wasn't in the control room dancing, they knew they hadn't gotten it yet, you know, that he'd be glum with his head in his hand. And Doug Dunn said, don't you hear what we're doing out here? It's great. But always, you know, they would play until they got him dancing, and that's when it was great.
Yeah, play until you get him dancing. Let's go to some phone calls. Wayne in Two Rivers is calling in. Hi, Wayne.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, Stax was instrumental in getting a lot of blues singers on record, too, like Albert King, that Born Under a Bad Sign. But in the 60s, they had, it was a really good album, but it was really different. It was an album by Gus Cannon, who is an old blues singer from the late 20s and the 30s. Now, how did that happen?
That's a great question. So what he's referring to is Memphis had been a recording hub for early blues, and Gus Cannon had been a banjo player and guitarist and had a jug band that had a big hit, one big hit called Walk Right In.
Oh, sure.
Which the Rooftop Singers later covered and made a million seller. Gus Cannon was cutting yards here at that time, and it was not long after that someone had sex. No, totally true. You know,
yes.
A friend of mine went to see him at the time and said that behind him was a BMI certificate for a million sellers on the Rooftop Singers version of the song, and he didn't have an LP. He didn't have a turntable to play the record on.
Oh, my gosh.
But somebody, I was very interested in finding out who in particular at Stax made the effort to go find Gus and bring him in. And I honestly don't have a truthful answer for you. I know a lot of people who didn't do it, you know, because I went to all the people I suspected would have made that effort, and it was someone I didn't encounter. But it's a hard to find record now out on CD, by the way, and it's Gus Cannon plucking the banjo, telling old stories about minstrel show days and singing fantastic songs. I highly recommend it.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. Thanks, Wayne, very much for your call. We'll take more phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking with the author of Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion. We have other performers to listen to and to talk about. We just mentioned Otis Redding. We'll look at Isaac Hayes, a big career with Stax, and he was the first African-American to go platinum. Sam and Dave, Wilson Pickett, the Staple Singers, Booker T and the MGs, and others. So all of that is coming up. And it's just the story itself is so remarkable, who the people were, how welcoming they were, how they didn't worry about the color of each other's skin. They just were welcoming to all. And as a result, built this phenomenal. I think at one point it was the fifth biggest African-American owned business in the country. And then it kind of fell apart. So we'll have to hear that story as well. Everything isn't always good, is it? Here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right. Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man? Can you dig it?
The theme from Shaft, Isaac Hayes, and another Stax recording wonder, actually. Isaac Hayes won an Academy Award for that song and the first African-American artist to go platinum. He was a big star for them, and they rewarded him pretty well, didn't they, Robert?
Oh, yeah. The I guess in the retroactive assessment, they might have rewarded him altogether too well for the company's good.
Right.
But the company really was built on his back. Isaac is one of the through characters in the Stax story. The Stax story is in two parts, and I break the book into two parts in the telling. And, you know, it's two fortunes made, two fortunes lost. And Isaac is there as a songwriter and producer in the first half, sort of behind the scenes, and in the second half, unexpectedly, becomes the star, and Shaft is certainly the pinnacle of his achievement.
Mm-hmm. And was it...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead. You're
well,
the author.
The label, you asked about the reward, and when Stax was becoming this international presence with, you know, putting on the Watt Stax concert and releasing feature films, really at the peak of their abilities, Isaac's contract came up for renewal. They really had been built on his back. He'd been the consistent hit maker, and they rewarded him with, among other things, a contract that included a blue, peacock blue and gold with real gold on the Cadillac car, you know, and it was real gold around the...
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
He said it was the pimp mobile to end all pimp.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Mobiles.
And there's a picture of it.
It was very fly.
Picture of it in the book. Now, was he the performer who was a meat packer early on?
Isaac came from perhaps, well, several of these guys, his partner David Porter, too, they both came from extremely humble means. Isaac actually slept in cars during part of his childhood. Both his parents died very young. And he was working as in a slaughterhouse when he began writing songs at Stax, and not until, you know, several hits in and he had some reliable income could he quit the slaughterhouse. He said sometimes he couldn't sleep at night. It was so gross, but it was what he needed to do to put food on the table. By the way, years later, when he moved back to town, you know, and he was sort of, he wasn't this superstar who had to be, who had to ride in limousines and be hidden. You'd see him all the time at the health food store. So I think that those days in the slaughterhouse made him a lifelong vegetarian.
That's an interesting story. And I guess we'll tell them, well, let's go to phone calls. We'll get to how money may corrupt in a little while, but too much money wasn't good for Isaac Hayes or for Stax perhaps as well. Let's go to more phone calls. Michael calling from Hayward. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Kathleen. Boy, this is a great show. This is really fantastic.
Great. I'm glad you're liking it.
I do have a comment. As I told your producer, Robert, I read your book on Muddy Waters, and you're the first author that I actually get to do this with. I want to thank you profusely for making your book on Muddy Waters especially available on Talking Books. And now, we're not talking about the commercial audio books that seem to be abridged, but the regular Talking Books for the Blind.
Ah, well, great. I believe this will be going out. This new book, Respect Yourself, should be following those same paths.
Oh, that's great.
Well, that's good. That's good, and I'll read it now. One more quick question, then I'll let you go. I'm just wondering too: is there a book out or going to be a book about High Records?
You know, a friend of mine, a writer named Jimmy McDonough, who wrote a Neil Young book, is working on a book about High Records, and I understand that the drummer and producer Steve Jordan is working on a documentary about High.
So,
and I'm a big High fan, and I used to hang out with Willie Mitchell, and man, it's still an amazing place to go over there at the Royal Recording Studio where High Records was based.
Okay, so that sounds good.
Thank you so much.
Thanks
Michael. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Gary next in Fitchburg. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I grew up down around Monroe, Wisconsin, and I played drums in a polka band starting when I was about 11 years old. This is back in, I guess, 1956, 57, something like that. And when I turned 16, I told my dad I'm starting a rock band, which I did, started my own rock band. And I used to listen to Wilson Pickett on my parents' big Zenith console with my drums sitting in front of it, cranked all the way up, listening to Wilson Pickett, trying to figure out how to play blues and funk. And I still play, man. So.
And what
you picked good training, because on most of those Wilson Pickett hits, the drummer is either Al Jackson Jr. out of Memphis or Roger Hawkins out of Muscle Shoals, and two guys with a whole lot of feel. So you did good.
What did your dad think of your playing? Was he supportive, or did he say, oh, you young people?
My dad was a saxophone player and a clarinet player. And he played in dance bands when he was young, and he was always supportive of my music.
Nice.
The last thing I'll say is that music used to be made with all the cats in the same space at the same time. It was more organic rather than this, where one cat now will lay down a sax part and somebody else all across the other country, side of the country will lay down a keyboard part. It's disjointed. It's not organic. It's not the same.
Yeah. Do you want to talk more about that, Robert?
Well, I was just going to say that the he's right. Everybody... Not only did everybody have to be in the same room, but that if one of them made a mistake, they all had to do it over again. So there was a lot of pressure on those guys to get it right. And you listen to songs like Last Night by the Marquise, or any of the Otis Redding songs, or the early Wilson Pickett hits. You know, anything, that's all everybody in the room. Sometimes they they got to where they could overdub horns, you know, but at Stax, basically, for the longest time, everybody was in the same room and not wearing headphones either.
Wow. Can you imagine the pressure of having to get it all right?
Yeah. Hey, look, we have danced to the proof that it works.
We'll hear the Wilson Pickett story in a moment, but let's set the stage. This is Wilson Pickett, also a Stax performer with Funky Broadway. Wilson Pickett. I'm listening to these songs thinking, we just got to throw a dance. You know, we just have to have a party. Don't you? You just, it's hard to sit down here behind a microphone. You just want to sort of get up and dance.
Oh, man, doing these radio interviews where, you know, part of it is we get to sit and play the records. It's such a delight.
I'll bet it is, Robert. So what's Wilson Pickett's story? How did he walk through Stax Records?
Well, Wilson Pickett was having some success with a little group in Detroit called the Falcons and wanted to be a solo star, real kind of big-headed guy, even at a young age. And Jerry Wexler at Atlantic sent him to Memphis, where Steve Cropper, the guitarist from Stax, picked him up. And actually, Wexler dropped Steve and Wilson off at the Lorraine Motel.
Oh.
It would have been about 2 or 3 years before Dr. King was assassinated there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where the players would hang out. They had a bottle of Jack Daniels, and the next day they came in and recorded you know, I'm hearing Funky Broadway, but that's not it. They came in and recorded Midnight Hour.
Oh,
Midnight
yeah.
Hour and another hit. They recorded three songs, two of which became huge hits quite quickly. And Wilson would come back to Memphis again, but ultimately the guys found him too hard to work with, and he went to Muscle Shoals, which is where Funky Broadway was recorded. Those guys were really influenced by what was going on in Memphis. So it was an indication that the soul sound was starting to spread pretty wide out of Memphis.
Oh, I like that song, Midnight Hour, too. Sing that. I won't do it, but I can sing that song for you right now. It just stays in your mind, doesn't it? You mentioned that he had kind of a big head. Could you say that was true of that money can kind of corrupt who you are? Was it true of Isaac Hayes as well? Or not?
Well, different. Isaac Hayes. Isaac Hayes became this big star on his way, you know, really without intention. So many things at Stax happened without intention.
Yes.
Isaac, you know, took to the stage, quickly became a star, was performing in tights as part of his act, and discovered pretty early on the road that big, tough club managers had no problem not paying a guy who was wearing tights. So Isaac had to get a tough guy to be his heavy to make sure he got paid, and that led to this a really intense corruption at Stax that ultimately I think pulls the bottom out, you know, from its own self because of this kind of rogue character in the business. It's a great the story of the whole label, just, you know, What happens next is never what you expect to happen, so it's really fun to read and write.
Yeah. When do they start carrying guns to protect themselves?
Yeah, that's around the time that Isaac has become a star and this thug is around, and there's gunplay, there's and this whole family feel that had defined. That's why it really is two periods. You know, there's this whole more. There's this business. This first time, the first half, it's this family that becomes successful. The second time, it's a business with a plan that, as it grows, and that success attracts ugly people like this thug. Guns start to come into play. Ultimately, I think that it's funny, the pursuit of the dollars led Stax to outbid CBS Records, the largest record company in the country at the time. Stax outbid them for a 12-year-old white Scottish girl who sang songs like Rosemary Clooney. You know, if anything could have ever been farther from their roots.
Right.
There was nothing farther from their roots, and that's what they found themselves, you know, pursuing just to try to get into more homes. The thought was, this will sell where Shaft hasn't reached, and then people will work their way back into what we do. But it didn't work.
Yeah. And what's the story, Robert, of how they lost their catalog to, I believe it was Atlantic Records?
Mm-hmm. At the end of the first period of Stax, which happens around... the final nail is when Dr. King is killed. Right before that is when Otis Redding dies, and that's also when Atlantic, which has been the Stax avenue to success. They could record the records, but Atlantic was able to get them in stores across the nation. So Atlantic was their legs. And Atlantic said, we've sold our company to another company, and Stax, and so that other company offered to buy Stax, very small offer that Stax passed on. And at that point, Jim Stewart learned that the contract he had signed and not read.
Oh,
just a classic error. They had had this informal agreement over a handshake, which had stood for about 3 or 4 years. And after that, when the success was coming, Atlantic wanted to formalize the deal. Jim said, you know, Jim just basically said, is this our agreement? And they said yes. And when, at this time in 68, when Atlantic sold itself, all the masters that Atlantic had distributed became the property of Atlantic. It's just a brutal, it's a total evisceration of the body. The record company lost control of all the records they had released.
Mm. Were you in Memphis?
And came back huge.
Yeah, remarkable. Were you in Memphis when Dr. King was assassinated?
I was about 6 or 7 years old. It's when I learned the word curfew.
Really?
I remember, you know, I have vague memories of all that stuff. I remember my father, he was an attorney downtown, and he brought my brother and I to his office, raised the window and had us look down on the street below, and we saw the sanitation workers marching in silence. You know, that was their thing, was they weren't, it wasn't this angry chanting. It was this dignified, silent, powerful march asking for, you know, recognition and basic human decencies on the job.
Mm-hmm. And what did that do to Stax Records? You talk about in the book that a lot of, and you mentioned some of them, people would frequent the Lorraine, artists would stay there, and it was associated in some ways with Stax. That must have hit them so hard.
Oh, it was like, you know, it was the nearest place to home for Stax, you know, besides their recording studio. The Lorraine Motel had a swimming pool and a coffee shop, and it would serve an integrated party. This was at a time in town when, you know, 1968, these guys still couldn't go get a meal together. And at the Lorraine, they could be served, they could swim in the pool. So it was, the loss of Dr. King was a loss of a real spiritual leader for the nation, but for these guys at their home base in particular. Many of them, Isaac Hayes was creatively drive for a year. You know, people just were reeling from this for a long time. I think that wound in this city is something we're still getting over, the assassination.
We welcome more phone calls. We're talking this hour about Stax Records and the soul explosion. The author of Respect Yourself, Robert Gordon, is our guest this hour, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter, we're on Twitter. Indeed we are, and that's... I always feel so with it when I say this. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Sue me, baby, sue me. Sue me with your kindness. For you know your power of loving it. Sue it to me. One more time. Sue me, baby, sue me. Sue me.
Sam and Dave, more Stax Records stars in the 1960s. Robert Gordon is our guest. Respect Yourself, The Soul Explosion is the name of his book. Yet another couple stars. There were so many of that came from Stax, weren't there? I keep asking the same story, but how did they find Stax? Or did Stax find
Sam
them?
Sam and Dave were these guys down in Florida that the Atlantic people discovered, and Atlantic was realizing that, you know, though they had done the Ray Charles stuff in the 50s, they'd kind of lost their mojo, so they were sending their talent to Memphis, and Sam and Dave came down. Sam Moore told me, he said he went to a meeting in Jerry Wexler's office in New York, you know, up the elevators. Sam's up from Florida. Oh, boy, you know, the Big Apple, and the Atlantic people tell him, Sam, you're going to Memphis. He said tears ran down his cheek. Country music. But he came down here, and Sam and Dave hooked up with Isaac Hayes and David Porter, and it was a real case of double dynamite. The songwriters found their voice, and the singers found their souls in the partnership, and that's where we have, you know, songs like Hold On, I'm Coming, and Soul Man, and When Something's Wrong with My Baby. It all came out of that collaboration.
Yeah. And are we talking, just tell me about the different categories. What's the difference between R&B music and soul music?
Oh, you know, more than anything else, I would say time period. You know, to me, I think it's all pretty, not specific. There's the R&B grew out of blues, right? So come the 50s, they started to call it R&B. In the 60s, they started to call it soul, you know. I think it's just names that change. I don't think there's any particular definition that would hold.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Kurt, our next caller from Sparta. Hello, Kurt.
Good afternoon. Great show. I'm curious if there's some way that we can tie this all in, if it had good connotations or bad connotations as far as Phil Walden and Associates and how he tied in with some of these artists, like Otis Redding and Johnny Johnson.
Sure.
And others that really helped tie the white and the black together.
You said Phil Walden, right, from
Correct.
From Macon. Right, yeah.
Correct.
He's referring to the guy who managed Otis Redding and was a concert booker in Georgia who would bring, initially was booking at the universities, would bring black bands to white fraternities, which is how a lot of the cultural exchange began, and became a guy who had the Capricorn Records label, where things like the Allman Brothers, and I think that Phil Walden and Rick Hall and Muscle Shoals and all these guys, you know, Jim Stewart in Memphis, they were following the sound that worked, and they weren't concerned whether it was black people or white people. You had a recognition. I mean, Rick Hall and Muscle Shoals, he was raised in the backwoods, and I would venture to say as feral a life as anybody you want to, you know, posit. And all these guys just didn't let the wrongs of society dominate them. They had, you know, good hearts, open minds. They knew that music was an exchange of ideas, and you always needed new ideas. I mean, I think the success of all this music in the South at this time is the good lesson, the coming together and the sharing of ideas and the change that produces, both artistically and socially.
Yeah.
That's the real success story.
And what about the broader change socially when you look at how Stax operated and how welcoming it was, how talent flourished there and how black and white got along there? What effect did it have on the broader Memphis community or beyond Memphis?
Well, yeah. You know, to sort of start with the smaller rings, the Stax, I think that in this growth period of Stax in the latter years, Al Bell was trying to give middle-class existence to people who'd been denied it. And in a way that was also part of the problem, because he was hiring as much as he could, which was a great thing, but of course it became very expensive. But that coming together, for one, he's giving people a good life. For as long as he could maintain the label, people who hadn't been well paid were being well paid. Then the city itself never appreciated Stax in its lifetime. It was still. It wasn't until Elvis died, frankly, in 1977, when the white people who run Memphis became aware that this black music they'd always disdained was actually commercially valuable. When Elvis died and fans from around the globe flocked here, you couldn't buy flowers in the city. The phone system went down.
Really?
You know, it was an international, and the people who run the city began to go, well, maybe we can hate it and make money off of it, or, you know, and soon enough they opened their minds to it. And I think that was in part, you know, what they could open their minds to was Stax. And I think that you hear in those songs the people getting along. That's part of it's written in the grooves with the beats. And so I think that's the great cultural gift it gives us.
Yeah. We should talk a little bit more about Al Bell, who became quite a hot shot, and how he and Jimmy met each other and how he became as substantial as he was in the whole music industry, because his story is quite remarkable as well.
It is. And you referred earlier to the phone call
right.
And when Al is brought in to the company in 1965, the company, you know, is so small that he's got to share a desk and a phone with Jim. They sit on opposite sides of the desk. And Al told me this very moving story about being so impressed that when Jim Stewart finished his call and slid the phone to Al, and Al made his call and slid the phone back to Jim, Al expected Jim to pull out Lysol, spray the phone, wipe it off, and then make his call in front of Al, you know, as if to say you're dirty.
Right.
But that didn't happen, and Al knew then that, you know, that there was hope at this company. And they called Al Bell the Otis Redding of business. You know, he was this 6'6" or 6'4" powerhouse, a rocket in wingtip shoes, and he'd been destined for a life as a in the church as a preacher, but had been booking gospel dances and just loved the power of the music. And he's the one who grew Stax into this massive company. He was the one who shepherded Isaac Hayes to stardom. And it was really Al's vision that Al was the first one there who had a long-term, big-sky vision. He saw movies. He wanted Stax to basically become what Sony Records has become.
Wow.
And he began to build it. And he built it till it was pretty dang big before it all went tumbling down.
And what about Estelle? It must have been rather unusual to have a woman at the forefront of the whole recording industry.
And it caused some tension, but Estelle stood her ground. Estelle, she's really the secret hero of the book. Songs like Last Night by the Marquees, some of the Sam and Dave hits. She's the one who forced them out. Her brother, the other owner of the company, you know, as the man at that time, he had more control. She said one night, there was so much demand. She was getting calls in the record store all day for this song called Last Night, but Jim wouldn't put it out. There was a local, they were playing it on local radio on a little, you know, test copy, and that she had a cry. She had a curse. Jim had seen her cry. Jim had never heard her curse. She cursed, and Jim said, okay, okay, get the record out tomorrow. Yeah, she really had, she stuck to her ways. She made a bunch of money when she was bought out by Al Bell in 69, had to stay out of the biz for 5 years, comes back in the mid-70s and records. Just as Stax is sinking, she has the biggest hit of her life, Disco Duck. It's just unbelievable, you know, the bizarre tie-ins in this story.
Wow, it is. And just in terms of the musicians, I'm wondering at what point and what prompted the decision, because it was kind of a big deal. We take it for granted now, but you write about making music for the first time. Musicians were put on salary here, so they didn't have to drive people around town or work at the meatpacking plant, or they could make a living being a musician. Was that a radical idea?
Well, it was, and it was a late idea. I mean, it was hard to get Jim, who ran the company, had a background in banking, and he was very penurious. So it was these guys had to work their night gigs for a good long while before they could get on salary. But Jim came to appreciate that what he was buying was worth the money, because I don't think Jim trusted the company for a long time. I mean, the success in the entertainment business is so whimsical, you know, that he thought it might go away. But in short order, the number of hits they had in a short amount of time indicated that they were, whatever they were doing it right.
They sure were. There were a lot of hits. It must have been great fun for you, Robert, to put this book together.
Well, yes and no. You know, it's hard. It's very hard to write a book. And though this was a subject I'm passionate about and I love it, you know, you face it's a complicated story to tell. I'm so pleased that the response has been as favorable as
yes, it has.
I've tried to make it easy to read and work on a lot of levels, and it seems to be working out. So that makes those dark hours, you know, feel worth it.
Right. Thank you so much for being with us. Great fun talking to you.
Ton of fun. Thank you all in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, thank you.
Come see us in Memphis.
All right. Come see us in Wisconsin. Robert Gordon, and the book is Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion. The preface is from Booker T. Jones. He says it's a work of gargantuan proportions. This tome is the labor of love, just as were the efforts of many of the characters who helped create Stax Records. Coming up in just a little while, Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickard on Central Time, looking at the rise of wildlife in America's cities and suburbs. And that's on Central Time from 3 until 6 today. We want to tell you, oh yeah, KP reminded me to tell you that we've crossed a milestone on our Facebook page. We love Facebook. I don't know if you do or not, but I'm really into Facebook. Well, we've just reached 3,900 likes on Facebook, and we would love to see if we can reach 5,000 before the end of the year. That would be marvelous. So share our page with a friend. We've got some great things on it, including information about this hour and the last hour. You'll want to trace the journey across this whole planet, the 7-year journey. It's worth, you know, that's worth a lot. So share our page with a friend, or if you haven't already, just join up for The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Thanks very much. Thanks to Robin Cherry for producing the hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing here in our studios. We're going to go out with kind of a theme song from the 1960s, Respect Yourself.